And the question I get asked most is, if you had it to do over again, what would you do differently? And to be honest, you know, I wouldn't have spent 21 years as a CEO building billion-dollar businesses for other people. I would have started my own empire earlier. And I do think the American dream, call it the entrepreneurial spirit, far from dead. You know, based on my activities the last couple of years, there's about to be a resurgence, I think, in small business. And small business becoming bigger business.
You're listening to Cary Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening and watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm your host, Cary Lutz. Hey, we're just about at the end of October. And so far, no crashes. But the person you're about to hear from isn't here to talk about crashes. No, he's talking about building your billion-dollar dream. And author of, and also returning guest, author of new book, Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion, and your name is Adam Coffey, and your book is officially an Amazon bestseller. The only place where it's not a bestseller now, I think, is in Antarctica, Oceania. It's a bestseller. Asia, Europe, South America, North America, all these places. So it's a book you definitely want to get. Adam, it's great to have you back on. So, according to your book, the American dream is not yet dead.
It is not, Cary, and glad to be back. Thank you for having me back. Hello to all your listeners out there. I would tell you, matter of fact, you know, the question I probably get asked the most, I spent 21 years as a CEO building three companies for nine different private equity firms. And the question I get asked most is, if you had it to do over again, what would you do differently? And to be honest, you know, I wouldn't have spent 21 years as a CEO building billion-dollar businesses for other people. I would have started my own empire earlier. And I do think the American dream, call it the entrepreneurial spirit, far from dead. You know, based on my activities the last couple of years, there's about to be a resurgence, I think, in small business. And small business becoming bigger business, which is really what the focus of my book was about.
All right. So how do you take a small business and turn it into a billion-dollar moneymaker here?
Well, let me start with a story, if you don't mind. You know, when not too long ago, a billionaire, and I have an NDA in place, so I can't disclose the name, but said, you know, please come see me in Greenwich, Connecticut. I'm having a problem with a company I own, and I'd like to talk to you about fixing it. Giant company. Everybody in America would know the name of this company, and it's kind of lost its way over time. And, you know, he's talking to me about, how do you fix this large business. And you know, we've had three CEOs come in fail, and it's like, you know, what would you do differently? And to answer your question, I'm getting there in a roundabout way, but the answer is, I don't fix the big company. I go back to the unit level economics. I don't need to fix 6,000 service vehicles, you know, and hunger. I got to fix one truck, one service call, one service event. And when I focus on the unit level economics of this business, in essence, I'm fixing this global behemoth. And one of the things I noticed, Cary, was that, you know, when the statistics are just scary and shocking. If you go to SBA.gov, you know, and you find out about small business, 33 million small businesses in America today, only 7% get to $1 million of revenue. Only 40% are profitable. More than half will go bankrupt over the next 5 years. Why can't anybody seem to get it right? And the more I looked into that, as a guy who's bought 58 businesses, it all comes down to unit level economics. If, you know, in order to build a perfect big company, you have to start by building a perfect small company. And if you can get that perfect business dialed in, between $100,000 in revenue and $1 million in revenue, then I guarantee you what you have is a scalable business that, with some tools that I talk about and teach,
you can get to that elusive $1 billion mark, but it starts by building the perfect small business. Unit level economics are where most people go astray. And tons of entrepreneurs tell me, you know, Adam, I'll worry about how to get profitable when I get bigger. And I tell them, wrong answer. Yeah. Worry about how to get profitable when you're small, because otherwise you waste time. And that's the one thing we can't buy.
So true. And one of the things that I do in my spare time, I was a mentor for Service Corps retired executives SCORE, and I built a number of businesses, and I specialize in this thing called the 90-day turnaround, guaranteed 90-day turnaround, because at this point in life, having done it with myself, I can walk into virtually any business that's not making money, that's losing money, or that isn't profitable enough, and I could spend literally an hour there, and I can turn that company around in 90 days. How? Because I've done it myself, because all the stupid things I've done, I can see in others, and more stupid things that I never even thought of.
As we get older, you know, old guys rule, you know, because we learn. We learn from having already made all these mistakes, you know, for sure. And I think about, you know, that what you just said, the 90-day turnaround. So I still look under the hood of hundreds of companies a year, and I'm doing that, doing operating partner work, you know, for PE firms, or I'm doing it as a coach, mentor to CEOs and founders who are scaling their businesses and trying to build them. And I apply this thing I call the 30-20-10 rule. And, you know, service businesses, not to sound sexist, ladies, but, it, you know, my world, my wheelhouse is guys, trucks, broken stuff, guys, trucks, building things. You know, guys, trucks doing something at a location. And I look at those businesses and it's like, you know, you got to turn 30%+ minimum at the gross profit line. You got to have SG&A at lower than 20%. And you have to have a minimum, a dime on a dollar net profit at the bottom. And if you're not in that 30-20-10 wheelhouse, just by looking at one financial statement, I know where to focus my efforts. You know, if I'm under 30% gross margin, I got to work on unit level economics. Yeah. Not charging enough, my service costs too much. If I'm over 20% SG&A, I'm spending too much money on the back office. And all of these things, I think we learn over time, help us now just quickly get in, evaluate a business. And once we know where it's broken, we know where to fix.
Yeah, and usually it's a combination of those three things for sure. You know, sometimes their costs are just too damn high, right?
Yeah.
And that could be the cost of goods, cost of services provided. It could be they got too many people working there, you know, could be a toxic employee that's the cause of it. There's so many potential causes, but like you said, you hone in immediately and you know exactly where to look. And then it just becomes a question of implementing solutions, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, strategic based, you know, initiatives, strategic planning, you know, management systems, you know, systematizing, using KPIs. I mean, all these things, you know, I learned this stuff, you know, back at GE in the Jack Welch era, and, you know, became a turnaround guy there. And at GE, when I was there for the 10 years I was there, the company was growing so fast. It was doubling in size every 2.8 years, and that equates to a 30% compound annual growth rate. So the other thing that I'm known for attacking, that's changed quite a bit over the years. You know, one of the things that I'm known for is building strong cultures, and then bending the growth curve and getting companies to achieve and hold a 30%+ compound annual growth rate. And there's a lot of different tools to use to do that, but you know, essentially, it's like all of the experiences that I've had across my career, you know, just kept being additive to each other. And ultimately, you know, I deal in cliff notes. And so what I tried to do with this book was to give entrepreneurs, whether they were a startup or already had a business, or they were a transitioning Fortune 500 executive who's running a middle market, you know, company for a PE firm, you know, try to give them the toolkit that an entrepreneur needs to be successful in any size business. And then to give them, you know, kind of the tools that you use at different size increments to help you then continue that journey. And the problems I see in companies that are, call it, between 10 and 30 million of revenue, very different than the problems I see when they're 100 to 200 million in revenue. And so as entrepreneurs pick up steam, as they learn, there's different tools that I pull out that get applied and help them continue to scale. And so my goal and objective, really, when I rotated out of the CEO seat a couple years ago, was instead of running and impacting one company at a time, I wanted to have a positive influence and impact on multiple companies at a time. And so that's what I'm doing today. I'm having fun. I work more hours now than I did when I was a CEO. And by the way, I make more money now than I did when I was a CEO too. So there's that risk reward quotients now, you know, better aligned, I think, as, you know, as an entrepreneur again.
Here's a question for you, Adam. When you walk into a company that's maybe losing money, maybe circling the drain, and you're not doing this for free, how do you get them to write you a check when they're circling the drain?
Well, generally, I try to start by focusing on companies that have what I call are enough clay. There's enough clay on the potter's wheel. So it's a big enough company to where I could instantly redirect some spend to create some capacity to implement change. But when I'm talking to shareholders or I'm talking to a board of directors, for me, it's like, look, this is how I work. I'm transparent. I have a track record. I've got billions in exits. You know, and this is the methodology I go about attacking problems. And you've got to be able to sign up for that, you know, in advance, knowing that, yeah, you know, I am a turnaround guy. I usually come in when others have failed or things have gone south. And it's like, I quickly need to arrest some, you know, I'm a pilot. It's like, you can pull back on the stick, but momentum keeps you going down for some level until you turn the corner. And so, you know, it's like the patient has to still have a pulse. Although I've done turnarounds in companies where I thought, you know, potentially chains may wind up on the door here, but, you know, but I managed to resurrect the patients. Right. So patience, I think, is required. But, you know, another place where I'm a maverick, I just do not believe in the fact that profit and culture are mutually exclusive. I believe that you can have a really strong employee culture, you can take care of employees, and you can make shareholders a boatload of money. And that's always been my methodology for success. And I think it's more popular today. It certainly wasn't, you know, if I roll tape back 25 years ago when I was a CEO for the first time. But, you know, I think we've evolved. You know, if you want to get employees, and, you know, everybody in the world wants to be a TikTok star and a social media influencer. But unless you can get people to work, if you want them to come work for you and stay, you got to have a better culture in today's world. And so I'm really focused on strong culture, gets an engaged workforce. Engaged workforce takes care of clients. Revenue just kind of rains from the sky. So,
yeah. So, like, what size business do you specialize in here?
So it depends. As a CEO, I was kind of a guy who would come in at about 200 million in revenue and take it from there. And I was a buy and build guy. So, you know, one of my empires was 23 companies bought and put together. Another one was 34, you know, companies bought and put together. As a coach and consultant, I'm finding myself, my sweet spot is below the lower middle market. So this is entrepreneur founded, not yet a private equity backed portfolio company, haven't been sold yet for the first time. They have aspirations to scale, to get bigger, and then potentially see their first exit. And so I would say my specialty today is I have clients as small as a million in revenue. I have clients that have, you know, 400 million in revenue, but kind of, you know, call it 1 to 50 million is a sweet spot where I think my skills can have dramatic impact in a short period of time with that entrepreneur, you know, helping them get over those hurdles that have stymied them. And part of that goes back to, Kerry, too, in buying 58 companies, I noticed something, and most of the companies that I bought would be average 20 to 30 million in revenue. And I noticed that entrepreneurs just had this kind of plateau. And in analyzing it, it's, they were, to be successful, they had to be anal retentive control freaks. And what happened as they got bigger is they ran out of bandwidth. And I needed to teach people how to go from being the first chair player in every section of the orchestra and to teach them how to be a conductor, how to let go, how to hire people, how to run and manage process rather than tasks. And when an entrepreneur finds that gear, boy, you know, revenue starts to take off.
Okay. So one of the things, like for a company that's not doing as well as it should be, especially when you're dealing with an entrepreneur, is the psychological aspects here, the emotional aspects, because they need that external view, because they can't, you know, the old saying, if you're in a hole, the first thing you need to do is stop digging. They're in that hole largely because of emotional reasons, whatever they might be, right? So you got to be part armchair psychologist here as well, don't you?
You really do. And I'll say, even it's common for me to encounter in this size entrepreneur. I just wrote an article for Forbes about it, and I called it the arrogance of success. And there are times, and I mean that in a loving way, not in a negative way, mm-hmm. but there are times where, hey, we beat the odds. You know, we beat that. We're one of the 7% that got to $1 million in revenue. Maybe yeah. we're one of the 4% of the 7% who got to 10 million in revenue. And so we start mm-hmm. to think, I know everything. You know, I'm impervious to making mistakes.
It's not going to work good for you.
No, and I don't need help from anybody else. And I think one of the things that's worked for me is just, you know, in life, when you have coaches and you have mentors, sometimes they come at it from an academic perspective. I've walked the walk. I've been in their shoes. I've built multiple mm-hmm. companies. I've had billion-dollar exits. And so I come as not a theorist, but a practitioner
right.
who's lived and walked in their shoes. And so sometimes I can break down those artificial defenses that they have and really get inside and help them and be helpful to them. And you know, all my engagements with clients too, by the way, are month to month. So if I don't add value, fire me. You know, and I can tell early on if someone is coachable. And that's a key to getting help is, you know, will they accept the help and advice? And if they will, I can work with that kind of person.
All right. And that is really it. Are they teachable? And, you know, but especially if the business isn't doing well and you're the entrepreneur and maybe you're having trouble making payroll, maybe you're having trouble making your mortgage payment, it gets really emotional. And then oftentimes the entrepreneur will be totally enveloped in fear-based mindset. So you've got to like shock them out of that, right?
You know, there's another group, I'll tell you, by the way. So what you're mentioning, I see again, and I see it again when entrepreneurs get over about the age of 50. And so they were successful early in their careers, they were building a business, and they start to become risk averse as they get older. They recognize that they've probably got too much, you know, asset concentration, their whole world's a business, they're starting to get older. And so now they stop making good business decisions because they're afraid to monkey with, you know, this thing called their company, which is the source of their future retirement if they monetize it. And now they start making mistakes because they're not taking the risks that they should be taking in order to right. keep the business growing and going. So I see it early when there's some struggle. But I then see it again as people get to a certain age point. And that's usually when I start to counsel people. And again, I wrote an article called the Rule of 130. And if an entrepreneur takes their age as a two-digit number and their percent of net worth tied up in their company, and you add those two digits, you know, those two numbers together, if it equals more than 130, chances are you're making bad business decisions and you have too much risk in something bad happening to that business. Think of all the things that are going on in the world today. We've got wars, we had pandemics. You know, good Lord, there's just so much. You know, the economic cycles are happening much quicker than they used mm-hmm. to. And it's a volatile world. And so we need to be concerned about asset concentration and diversifying risk. And so I see risk everywhere. And I see people, you know, kind of at the start being too nervous, you know, or and then at the end getting too conservative. And
right.
And both yield the same result, which is struggling business.
Hey, so what can we learn from Elon Musk when it comes to risk taking?
Well, yeah, so Elon would be my personal hero just from this standpoint. I call Elon
the this generation's version of Howard Hughes. And I think what makes Elon unique, whether you like him, love him, hate him, whatever, hey, here's a guy who, as a serial entrepreneur, started three businesses in completely different industries and had multi-billion dollar businesses come out of those visions. And, you know, you think of SpaceX and PayPal and Tesla, and, you know, boy, any one of those companies could have imploded and gone south. And, you know, as a stock trader, I think of Tesla and all the debt they had. And it was kind of like Amazon too, you know, and all of the infrastructure investment that was required to build this behemoth.
Mm-hmm.
Once it turned the corner, then, you know, they become everybody's, you know, everybody has a love fest with the potential of the stock, but boy, ton of risk. But they took that risk and they were rewarded for taking that risk.
You know, it's that old thing. It took me 10 years to become an overnight success.
Right? Yes. And
it's like people think like Tesla kind of, it's been around for 12 years now, I think, or maybe 14 years. So, but downright miraculous when you think of the auto industry, where we haven't had a new entrant, successful entrant in the auto industry, basically since before the Great Depression.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you think, you know, he's Preston Tucker, but he got it right, you know, and he actually made it work.
He was Tucker, who, you know, but an ace engineer, you know. So it's kind of amazing that he can pull this off, and it's not done yet. You know, he's got other AI company going, Neuralink, which, just think about it, all the millions of disabled people around the world. Spinal cord injuries, all the everything. And if he can somehow get these people to walk again, I mean, that may be his greatest achievement.
I think AI ultimately, so not just from a health perspective, but I think AI in general will completely revolutionize the world as we know it. And I think right now everybody's playing with it. We're not really sure how to use it or how to put it into our businesses. But my wife was just telling me yesterday, she was at a drive-thru at McDonald's and it was no longer manned by a person. It was AI. And the AI was really good at taking the order and she's Hispanic, understanding her English and you know, getting her through to the first person she encountered, which was the person who gave her the food. You know, and so it's touching everywhere. So I think Elon is just a serial entrepreneur who knows how to think on a level that most of us just can't comprehend or understand. And while he's, you know, there's some volatility around him in X and what have you. Again, I go back to, he's the modern day version of Howard Hughes in my mind. You know, it's like just
good analogy.
You know, the wealth of creativity and his success in multiple industries is just something that really we all should aspire to learn from, you know, at the very least. Because the world's filled with one-hit wonders.
Yeah.
People who had one idea.
Most people at best are one-hit wonders.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I've been blessed, you know, so I'm a three-hit wonder now.
All right.
On my books up there.
Three or four. You know. Three or four. So, hey. You know, when you were mentioning Elon being the modern day Howard Hughes, it reminded me of the story when Howard Hughes went to Las Vegas and he checked into the Desert Inn and they gave him the top floor, basically the entire floor. And he's there for like a couple of weeks and they go and say, Mr. Hughes, you know, you have to leave because we got high rollers that want this suite and you don't even gamble. And says, you know, let me get back to you. Give me a little bit. And basically calls up and says, how much do you want for the place?
Yeah, he buys the hotel.
Buys it. And I can see Musk doing something like that. You know, I really could.
Well, you have to think about Twitter as being a good modern day equivalent of that or X. And so Musk wants to have a voice. So what does he do? He buys the largest platform that would give him a voice and says, I own it, you know.
And now everyone hates him.
I think that the final chapter's not yet written there. So
can he make money at this? What's your take? I mean, this is a turnaround because that place was circling the drain. because they were basically a government organ, and they weren't there to serve a market. They were there to provide a platform for certain narratives, right?
Sure. So do I think he can, you know what? I would not bet against him. And I'll tell you why. He has been around the drain, as you said, multiple times with multiple companies and managed to take that, I'll call it the energy of circling the drain, and turn it into something that was pretty special. So I would not discount, I would not take the short, you know, on the over under. I wouldn't take the under on anything that Elon does. Maybe Hyperlink, you know, maybe I'd have to think about that one for a bit.
The Vegas loop, but they're doing it. You know, they're building these tunnels now. People are looking at it and saying it can't possibly work. But once you add a 12 or 16 passenger van to the mix, and then you can take, you know, literally five times more people to where they want to go per hour.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it starts like looking pretty good.
I think in his mind, most everything he comes up with is visionary, and it's going to push the envelope of humanity and technology. And so some things that fail won't fail because they were necessarily bad ideas. They may fail because the technology wasn't there to support it in today's world, or it was ahead of its time, what have you. But yeah. I would never count him out. And
for sure.
All right. I wouldn't bet against him.
All right. So the book, tell us the name again.
It's called Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion, and essentially it's the toolkit to take you from zero to a billion, and the stages of growth, the tools that are required, how you adapt, you know. And again, I'm a CEO. I don't like long meetings, and so this is the Cliff's Notes of 35 years of turnarounds and CEO experience, and it kind of builds off of the other ones, which were more singular in their focus. This one is broader, and it's really intended for entrepreneurs who are on that journey and hoping to add some wisdom, regardless of what stage of growth they're at, to help them be successful.
Okay. Well, hey, I love it, and definitely going to get a copy. I'll have you back on after I read it, talk about some of your anecdotes, experiences. Wish you the best of luck on the book. And I've got a question for Adam, myself. The email address is kl@carrylutz.com. Shoot me an email. And the links, all the links you need, will be in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Adam, been a pleasure. We will talk to you again real soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.